Gopi Jana Balaba Giravare Hari Gopi Jana Balaba Giravare Hari
Gopi Jana Balaba
Giravare Hari Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tira Pad Paramahamsa Parvraja Gachara Sutera Sutta Sri Shimya Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai Iskan Founder Charles Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai Samadvita Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai Gaura Premananda All glories to some of the devotees All glories to some of the devotees All glories to some of the devotees All glories to Sri Shri Guru and Sri Duranga Namam Vishnu Padaya Krishna Sahaja Gavaya Sri Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Namaste Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya So we're reading today from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 6, Text 3, Purusha Shukta Confirm. Okay. Rupanam Tejasam Chakshur
Rupanam Tejasam Chakshur
Diva Surya Shachakshini
Diva Surya Shachakshini
Karnau Disham Chatirthanam Shrotram Akasha Shabdayo Rupanam Tejasam Chakshur
Rupanam Tejasam Chakshur
Diva Surya Shachakshini
Diva Surya Shachakshini
Karnau Disham Chatirthanam
Karnau Disham Chatirthanam
Shrotram Akasha Shabdayo Rupanam Tejasam Chakshur
Rupanam Tejasam Chakshur
Diva Surya Shachakshini
Diva Surya Shachakshini
Karnau Disham Chatirthanam
Karnau Disham Chatirthanam
Shrotram Akasha Shabdayo
Tejasam
Opposed chant? Anyone? Rupanam, for all kinds of forms. Tejasam, of all that is illuminating. Chakshu, the eyes. Diva, that which glitters. Suryasya, of the sun. Cha, also. Akshini, the eyeballs. Karnau, the ears. Disham, of all directions. Cha, and. Tirthanam, of all the Vedas. Strotram, the sense of hearing. Akasha, the sky. Shabdayo, of all sounds. Translation and purport by Śrīla Prabhupāda. His eyes are the generating centers of all kinds of forms, and they glitter and illuminate. His eyeballs are like the sun and the heavenly planets. His ears hear from all sides and are receptacles for all the Vedas. And his sense of hearing is the generating cause of the sky and all kinds of sounds. We have a very short purport. Of course, Prangavanda got no purport yesterday. So. The word Tirthanam is sometimes interpreted to mean the places of pilgrimage. But Srila Jiva Goswami says that it means the reception of Vedic transcendental knowledge. The propounders of the Vedic knowledge are also known as Tirthas. Om Jnanati Brandisha Gananjana Salakaya Chakshuni Tamina Tasma Sri Gurubhina Maha Vanchikopa Tribhisha Kripa Sindhu Gevicha Patitano Pavana Dio Vaishnavi Namuna Maha. So we're hearing about the process of creation, and this is actually repeated, as we heard yesterday, in several cantos of the Bhagavatam, third canto and other places. And a nice explanation that Prangavinda gave yesterday about the overview, sort of the whole idea of the Virata Rupa. And the day before, in the first verse, we heard a nice explanation from Ran Govinda about how Krishna shows us both his power and majesty and his sweetness. So those are some nice themes that we've been hearing about during the beginning of the sixth canto. So it was explained yesterday that some of the technical aspects of hearing about this creation serve the purpose of, one, that we show that we understand the power, the grandeur of God, of Krishna, how he is really in control of everything, and also how we are very small and quite insignificant within this whole cosmic universe. Now, specifically, within this whole concept of creation and how it comes about, we've been talking about the Virata Rupa, and that's been described. And the Virata Rupa is this gigantic manifestation of the Lord within the material world. And it describes how Krishna enters in to all the senses, the objects of senses, the sense organs, and the corresponding material elements. So all these 24 material elements are all there. And there's a sequential development of creation from one element to the other. And as the elements expand one from the other, the senses, sense organs, objects of the senses, all of those are also created. Now, an interesting point about this, and actually in the readings today alluded to this somewhat also, that factually Krishna does not personally enter into the material world. He supplies the ingredients, Prakriti, but it's his agents such as Brahma that actually carry out the process of creating the material elements. And of course, in Bhagavad Gita, in the seventh chapter, when all the different elements are being described, Krishna describes these as Bina Prakriti Rashada, that these eight are my separated material energies. Interesting that he actually says these are separated from him. So what we can understand is the actual Virata Rupa is an imaginary form of the Lord. There is not actually a Virata Rupa, a huge manifestation that is Krishna's incarnation. That. And that's described actually in the very clearly in the first canto chapter 3, verse 30. Now, this verse comes right after we hear about all the scheduled incarnations, all of the different little avatars, and then, of course, the famous verse that Krishna is the, you know, Swayam Bhagavan, that he is the original source. And then it says this verse: the conception of the Virata universal form of the Lord as appearing in the material world is imaginary. It is to enable the less intelligent and neophytes to adjust to the idea of the Lord's having form. But factually, the Lord has no material form. In Srila Prabhupada's purport, he says, there's no difference between the body and self in Krishna as there is in the conditioned soul. The Virata Rupa is conceived for those who are just neophyte worshippers. For them, the material Virata Rupa is presented, and it will be explained in the second canto. In the Virata Rupa, the material manifestation of different planets have been conceived as his legs, hands, etc. Actually, all such descriptions are for the neophytes. The neophytes cannot conceive of anything beyond matter. The material conception of the Lord is not counted in the list of his factual forms. As Paramatma or Supersoul, the Lord is within each and every material form, even within the atoms. But the outward material form is but an imagination, both for the Lord and a living being. The present forms of the conditioned souls are also not factual. The conclusion is that the material conception of the body and the Lord is wrought as imaginary. So it's interesting that we have this, the universal form, the Virata Rupa, or ways that we see. And I think in an earlier, in the first canto, isn't the descriptions of Krishna as, you know, the mountains are his backbone, and, you know, all these different things, sort of like, there are ways that we can envision Krishna within this material world. So while Krishna does not personally contact the material energy, he certainly is the cause behind all creation. He's the source of all the ingredients. He's the controller of the demigods. So the idea is there that Krishna is behind all of this. And of course, with the Purusha incarnations, Krishna supports and maintains the universes. First, Garbhodakshaya Vishnu enters within each universe, and then Krishna enters into every jiva, and every atom is Paramatma, or the Shiradakshaya Vishnu, and he is controlling everything. But even though he is in control of everything, he is creating everything, directing everything, he does not actually ever take the material form. So we should understand this. This Virata Rupa is not an actual form, but it's a way of imagining Krishna in everything, behind everything, in the material world. Now, additionally, another description of how Krishna exhibits himself and his powers in the material world are through his vibhutis. Now, we see descriptions of Krishna's vibhutis in chapter 7, and then again in chapter 10 of the Bhagavad Gita, then also in the Srimad Bhagavatam, canto 11, chapter 16. There's a whole chapter about these different vibhutis of the Lord. What is a vibhuti? It's an object, a person, material or spiritual energy where Krishna personally invests his power, specifically in the material world. In other words, we can sort of see Krishna's power behind these different things. And of course, we have all sorts of famous ones in the Bhagavad Gita, like 7-8. O son of Kunti, I am the taste of water, the light of the sun and the moon, the syllable om in the Vedic mantras, I'm the sound in ether, the ability in man. In so many ways, Krishna shows how he invests his power or how he can be seen within the material world, to give us, especially neophyte devotees, a way of envisioning Krishna and how nothing is really separate from Krishna. In the purport to 10.17, which also has some more discussion of these vibhutis, says that while devotees always relish hearing about all of Krishna's glories, Arjuna actually asked Krishna to describe the vibhutis for the benefit of the common man. In other words, that, you know, so on ways that neophyte devotees can easily understand Krishna. But there is benefit also for the devotees in hearing these. So we think, okay, these are all for the common person. If they're not real or imaginary, why are we hearing these? Well, it's helpful to us as well. And Prabhupada gives a nice description of this little book. I think it's from a lecture of Prabhupada's on the way to Krishna. He says, inasmuch as we associate with God and we go on hearing the words of Krishna and his names, the contamination of material nature is reduced. Now, he's describing these verses in the seventh chapter. He says, and understanding that Krishna is sound, illumination, the taste in water, and so many other things, it becomes impossible to avoid Krishna. If we can remember Krishna this way, our association with him is permanent. So, however we can remember Krishna, of course, is good. That is the goal. The idea of hearing and chanting is remembering, to always remember Krishna. And so, it's great benefit to us if we can fix our minds somehow or another on Krishna, whether it's through the Vrata Rupa or his Vibhutis. If these are helpful to us, to always remember Krishna, then that's the goal. The objective has been reached. But we do remember that the devotees are actually more interested in Krishna's spiritual aspect, his spiritual sweetness and all of that, than these temporary or even sometimes imaginary manifestations in the material world. And of course, Krishna concludes the description of all his vibhutis in 1041, Bhagavad Gita. Know that all opulent, beautiful, and glorious creations spring from but a spark of my splendor. Then the next verse, what need is there, Arjuna, for all this detailed knowledge? For the single fragment of myself, I pervade and support this entire universe. So this is sort of the conclusion for the devotees of this. And Prabhupada says in the purport to that verse, the Supreme Lord is represented throughout the entire material universes by his entering into all things as the Supersoul. The Lord here tells Arjuna there's no point in understanding how things exist in separate opulence and grandeur. We should know that all things are existing due to Krishna's entering into them as Supersoul. From Brahma, the most gigantic entity, on down to the smallest ant, all are existing because the Lord has entered into them all and is sustaining them. So these are some of the things I think that we can, some of the takeaways or things that we can understand from reading about the Vrata Rupa or Krishna's powers of creation, the processes of creation. Now, specifically going to today's purport, we're talking about how the ears of the Lord are receptacles of Vedic sound. And Srila Prabhupada quotes Jiva Goswami saying, Tirthanam means receptacles of Vedic transcendental knowledge. Well, I went to Jiva Goswami's Krama Sandarbha, his commentaries on the Srimad Bhagavatam. And this verse, he says, Tirthanam means receptacles of Vedic transcendental knowledge. That's all he says. So that's all we get. But anyway, so we have that. That it's a little bit different definition than we often think of Prabhupada says Tirthanam meaning place of pilgrimage. But there's a connection there. Because Srila Prabhupada also mentions many places that Tirtha can be interpreted as a place of pilgrimage, but propounders of Vedic knowledge are also known as Tirthas. So we've heard this, I think, several times before, where Prabhupada says that the real value of visiting holy places of pilgrimage is hearing from the enlightened sadhus who reside there. So in other words, even greater benefit than tirthas or places of pilgrimage is actually hearing transcendental knowledge. And I was thinking about that as we often in India, if we go to India and we go to different places like Vrindavan or Mayapur, it's not like we go to these different tirthas. It's not like we necessarily see a lot of holy people that are giving us a lot of knowledge about them. I mean, unless you make a special effort, I guess, to do that. But then I was thinking, though, that all of the knowledge, why are we even going to these places? All the knowledge that we have of them is from Srila Prabhupada. In other words, we have descriptions, and of course, other advanced devotees, might tell us more pastimes about these. So basically, we're hearing in from, of course, the six Goswamis who developed a lot of these places of pilgrimage. So it's all being heard and understood through the specific succession, through parampara in this way. It helps us to understand these tirthas or places of pilgrimage. So the emphasis here that Prabhupada is giving to this verse is to put stress on the importance of hearing Vedic knowledge, and specifically hearing from the great devotees, who are they themselves considered and called tirthas. So Vedic knowledge comes from Krishna, is compared to the ears and hearing, and this pure spiritual sound vibration, even in the material world, remains pure. The spiritual sound permeates everywhere. This is from a lecture in 1968 in Los Angeles. Prabhupada says, Shabda Brahma, sound vibration. So the sound is all-pervading. This transcendental sound, just like your radio message, television sound, they cannot go beyond this earthly planet at most. But there is a sound which can penetrate the whole universe and go to the spiritual world. If that sound is potent, then it can penetrate even this material sky and go to the spiritual sky and go to Krishna directly. That sound is Hare Krishna. Golokara Premadana Harinam Sankirtan. From Narottam Das Thakur, the treasure of divine love in Goloka Vrindavan has descended as the congregational chanting of the Lord's holy names. So, Srila Prabhupada says there's a distinction between material sound and spiritual sound. And we actually understand this. We can appreciate this and experience this because we tire of material sound. You know, no book or song, whatever it is, remains popular. You have to have one after another, whether it's a song, a movie, a whatever it might be, a book or something. You know, they keep rotating them because people tire of them. And in fact, you see, the only books that seem to remain popular over thousands of years are usually religious books, aren't they? I mean, people still read the Bible, the Quran, of course, all the Vedas. You know, so in other words, you can say there is some special power in spiritual literature. You know, now, what to speak of, you know, the Vedic literature where you have spiritual sound vibration, which is non-different. You know, in other words, the words, the sounds themselves are non-different than the meaning. You know, where material sound vibration, there's a difference between the word itself and its intrinsic meaning or what it is, right? In other words, you have, it's an example, you have a table, and you call it table in English, and what they call it in Spanish, mesa, and there's, you know, so many other, in other words, it can be called so many different things. There's no particular meaning or reason why there's a sound vibration that describes that item. It's arbitrary. But spiritual sound vibration in Sanskrit is not like that, because there's an identity between the word, the sound, and the thing itself. There's a philosophical term for that understanding, but whatever it is. But anyway, so that's very important. It's a very, very clear distinction. I was thinking about this, how words, not only do we tire material sounds, but they actually lose meaning. Now, this was kind of interesting. This is, I guess this is a psychological explanation. There's something called semantic satiation effect. See, aren't you glad you came? You get these special little tidbits here. Okay, semantic satiation effect. Basically, seeing or hearing a word over and over elicits a reaction from your brain to recognize the meaning of the word. But when the repetition is rapid, neurons start to fire one after another, causing peripheral sensory motor activity to occur in rapid succession. This then causes reactive inhibition, which is basically a lessening of the reaction the more the stimulus is exposed to. And thus, eventually, it causes the thing unable to even recognize the word as a real word. So it begins to sound like gibberish. You know, so Prabhupada always gave the example, if I chant water, 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 it's not going to quench your thirst. But not only that, if I keep chanting water, water, water long enough, I won't even know what the word means. It just all becomes a blur in my brain. Now that does not happen with spiritual sound, does it? And with mantras, we experience the difference because attentive, constant repeating of the chanting of Hare Krishna, it doesn't lose all meaning, become gibberish. It actually deepens its meaningfulness. Right? The more that we deeply hear and appreciate and really sort of, you know, get very much deeply into the chanting, we actually begin to hear the holy name through that repetition. It's not that we lose hearing. We actually begin. In fact, we even say that often, don't we? You know, you should need to hear your rounds or try to hear better, right? So it's chanting and also hearing. And as we chant, we increasingly understand what? The non-difference of Krishna and his holy name. So that's like one of the real, I guess, signs. That's when you feel like you're making a little bit of advance when you're chanting, or you feel like your chanting is good that day, when you start actually feeling Krishna in his name, that it is not different, that he's right there with us. Prabhupada said, when we chant Hare Krishna, Krishna's dancing on our tongue. I haven't really experienced that one, but I believe it. Anyway, so we increasingly understand the non-difference from Krishna. And hearing or reading the Vedic literature has a similar effect. Hearing from pure devotee or reading the Shastra, because many, many devotees read the Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita over and over and over, right? Read the same words, the same page. Of course, we have so much literature that, you know, it takes me a while to read it more than once or twice. But still, you know, it's always fresh and new. New things are learned. We read things we didn't even know were there. We get deeper understanding. We get different realization, right? Every time that we pick up one of Srila Prabhupada's books. I've been reading Krishna book again, and how many times have we all heard Krishna book stories, right? Over and over throughout, you know, years and years and years. But yet, you go and you read them, and they're fresh again. They're exciting and wonderful. I was reading, last night, I was reading about the killing of Kamsa. And, you know, Jai Hari Bol, I love that. It's one of my favorite, I have to say. I mean, I like the Vrindavan pastimes, basically, the most. But my next favorite is killing when Kamsa gets killed. I loved it. I'd like to see that baby killer get what he deserved. Anyway, moving on. But the point is, I mean, how many times I've heard that story, but yet hearing it again last night, it was fresh and new and exciting, you know, and gives you that sense of transcendental spiritual happiness, you know. So it's, we experience this. This isn't something theoretical. We actually experience the difference in hearing transcendental sound, Srimad Bhagavatam, transcendental stories, words from the guru, like that. Okay. In 10.1.13, Prabhupada says, even though advanced devotees hear continually about the Lord for years, they still feel that these topics are coming to them as newer and fresher. Therefore, such devotees cannot give up hearing the pastimes of Lord Krishna. So there's great benefit and effect from hearing spiritual sound from pure devotees. We become detached from material things, and we become attached or attracted to Krishna. So hearing attracts our mind to Krishna, his pastimes, his service, his devotees, everything about him, his holy dhams. And we may not even understand this on a material platform, how this is happening, but our spiritual nature is gradually being revived from within as the process of hearing and chanting goes on. So it's a real change. The spirit soul is a change of heart, a transformation and spiritualization of our consciousness from this process. And we develop this taste from hearing from pure devotees. I was thinking, another factor in this is not just the purifying effect of hearing from pure devotees, but, I mean, we could barely understand the Shastra without the guidance of Guru and the Sadhus, could we? I mean, did anyone try reading any of the Vedic literature before contacting Srila Prabhupada? Did you get a lot out of it? No. I read Bhagavad Gita, some version of Bhagavad Gita. I thought it was cool, you know, interesting, but I had no idea what it meant. When Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita, everything came clear, like that. It's the difference between, it, you know, and a lot of the words are the same. That Prabhupada even told, was it Hayagriva who was first translating, or I forget, but he even said to him that because he wanted to use some of the translations from other Bhagavad Gitas in Prabhupada.
Dr. Ramakrishna.
Okay. And he said, Prabhupada said, that's okay. You know, he said, the main thing is the purport. The important thing, do not change my purports. Because, you know, the verse, whether he'd like to make it a little more poetic sometimes, which is nice, you know, just saying it in nicer and maybe in a kind of more poetic way, but don't change the explanation, the meanings, the purport from the pure devotee who can illuminate what the book is saying, what the Shastra and Bhagavad Gita is saying, Krishna's words. So this association with pure devotees is, and hearing from them is so important. The results of hearing, Jiva Goswami in Bhaktisiddharva Anuchuda 11, he quotes the Bhagavatam verse, O twice-born sages, by serving those devotees who are completely freed from all vice, great service is done. By such service, one gains affinity for hearing the message of Vasudeva. And then Srila Jiva Goswami says, generally taste develops by association with great devotees. By serving great devotees, taste for the Lord's topic develops. Meeting those devotees, one develops faith in worshiping the Lord, and then a desire to hear. From hearing, taste develops. Hearing from great devotees has immediate effect. And of course, in this verse in the Bhagavatam, this word ruchi is used specifically, which we know means taste. And that's one of the great benefits. When we hear from great devotees, we also get... The taste is actually coming from the taste that the pure devotee is feeling. So we get some of the benefit of that. It's what is it? Chaya attachment or paribhasa attachment. There's a couple different phrases that are used in the nectar devotion, which means that, you know, that we get some of the, we may get a very, very strong taste, even as a neophyte, which is somewhat coming from the spiritual master and coming from entering the process. In other words, it may not remain until we become more advanced and more purified, but it's there. We get this taste from this association. And then he quotes the Srimad Bhagavatam 3:25:25, real nice verse. In the association of pure devotees, discussion of the pastimes and activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is very pleasing and satisfying to the ear and heart. By cultivating such knowledge, one gradually becomes advanced on the path of liberation, and thereafter he is free, and his attraction becomes fixed. Then real devotion and devotional service begin. Prabhupada says, his purport to that verse, the process of advancing Krishna consciousness and devotional service is described here. The first point is one must seek the association of persons who are Krishna conscious and engage in devotional service. One must give up the association of materialistic persons and seek the association of devotees. Because without the association of devotees, one cannot understand the activities of the Lord. Okay. So the hearing should come from pure devotees. One may even begin hearing and chanting, but only association with pure devotional service or pure devotees does it become truly purifying. And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur describes that in his purport to 3:25:25, where he says, only by association with devotees does the mind develop attraction to the Lord. The stages are described here. The previous verse mentioned that association should be desired. Then faith first arises. From excellent association of devotees, stories of my pastimes become nectar for the ears. From inferior association, there is only bhajana kriya, but the stories do not become nectar. Thus, from excellent association, the stories cause anartha nivritti. Then those stories cause nishta, then ruchi, etc., up to prema. So again, it's not just hearing the pastimes of Krishna or the stories of the philosophy, but hearing from the right source, hearing from the pure devotee, then there's the real effect. In other words, if you just hear the stories from anybody, you don't necessarily experience anartha nivritti or the purification process. You know, but that will happen when you hear and associate with the pure devotee. Yeah, another part of the Srimad Bhagavatam that I was just, when I was kind of looking at through some of the verses, and first I was remembering in Canto 11, Chapter 26, that goes back a few years when we were studying that, and the Uddhava Gita. That Chapter 26 is called the Ila Gita. Does anyone know what Ila means?
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Ila Gita.
What does it mean?
It's just Krishna speaking to Uddhava.
Okay, I didn't know what that word Ila exactly meant. But anyway, but he describes the negative effects of bad association with, who was it? Purandar? Who was it?
Pururava.
Yeah, Pururava is associated with Urvasi, and he falls down. And then then there's a lot of discussion about the positive effects of hearing from saintly devotees at the end. So I'm just going to read verses 26 through 34 because they're really nice. It says, an intelligent person should therefore reject bad association and instead take up the association of saintly devotees whose words cut off excessive attachment of one's mind. My devotees fix their mind in me and do not depend upon anything material. They are always peaceful, endowed with equal vision, and free from possessiveness, false ego, duality, and greed. Whoever hears chants respectfully takes to heart these topics about me, becomes faithfully dedicated to me, and achieves my devotional service. Just as food is the life of all creatures, just as I am the ultimate shelter for the distressed, and just as religion is the wealth of those who are passing away from the world, so my devotees are the only refuge of persons fearful of falling into a miserable condition of life. My devotees bestow divine eyes, whereas the sun allows only external sight, and that only when it is risen in the sky. My devotees are one's real worshipable deities and real family. They are one's own self, And ultimately, they're none different from me. That's a beautiful description of the value of association with devotees and how beneficial that is. In fact, it says that the hearing from pure devotees bestows upon one divine eyes. It's interesting, divine eyes. In other words, that spiritual vision, to be able to see things spiritually, not just materially. So we need to receive those divine eyes from the pure devotee to be able to deeply understand. And because without the guidance of the gurus and the sadhus, the shastras' inner meanings are difficult to understand. They even in the scriptures themselves, they mention that. In the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, chapter 9 is called confidential knowledge. And in the first verse, this word guya is used, which means confidential. So Srila Prabhupada explains what this confidential knowledge is in that purport. He says, confidential knowledge is pure devotional service and the nine processes to achieve it. So real confidential knowledge is this understanding of bhakti, of pure devotional service, Krishna prema. Now here's another interesting one, is that before the Chatur Shlokas, which is really, I just realized it's coming up in a couple chapters, chapter 9 for us, but before he recites the four verses, Krishna gives a couple introductory verses to Brahma. And first he describes that the knowledge is secret or confidential. It says, Sri Bhagavan Vacha, Kyanam Paramam Guhyam Ne, Yad Vijnana Samanvitam, Sarahasyam Tadangam Cha, Vihana Garitam Maya. Word Guhyam again. The personality of God had said, knowledge about me as described in the scriptures is very confidential, and it has to be realized in conjunction with devotional service. The necessary paraphernalia for that process is being explained by me. You may take it up carefully. Then, of course, he's going to instruct Brahma on what he needs to know, really the spiritual knowledge, not the details of creation, but what he has to understand spiritually before he begins that process of creation. And then in the purports there, Prabhupada quotes again Jiva's commentary, these verses. Srila Jiva Goswami, this is in the Bhakti Sandarbha, Manichita 1.5, explains the most secret knowledge is prema bhakti. And his third line, sarahasyam tad angam cha, he says, rahasyam, which can mean secret, means Krishna prema. And it's part, anga means like part or an arm, you know, means the sadhana. So Jiva states that the abhideya, or the method, the process of is bhakti. Bhakti is both the abhideya and the prayojana. It's the means and the end. Prayojana is the goal, the ultimate goal. So bhakti is both the sadhana, the process, and the sanga, the perfection. So everything comes down to the what's the most confidential meaning of the Vedas, of the Shastra? Well, for us, it's really not that confidential. It's one of those what they call an open secret. It's bhakti. It's performing devotional service, love and devotion to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and developing that loving relationship, ultimately to Krishna Prema. So we need to always keep the goal in mind, Krishna Prema, that that's where we're headed, that's the purpose while we're executing our sadhana, and that sadhana must be performed under the guidance of the pure devotee, hearing from the guru, and that the best process to achieve the perfection is, again, hearing from the pure devotees, and chanting of the holy name of Krishna. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I'll end there. I'll go to Srila Prabhupada. Comments or questions? Oh.
It's called Aila Gita because Puru Rava is known as Aila, Ila's son.
Oh, it's the name of Puru Rava.
Okay. Puru Rava, yeah. And second is, thank you, sir, for such a nice class. I remembered how Radhana Swami went after for writing Journey Home to Himalayas. And when he went there, all these people thinking Himalayas is Tirtha because of Lord Shiva, Ganges are so close. And when he went there, he saw there were locks put on the Himalayan caves.
Locks, okay.
And chains are put on the caves because yogis are fighting with each other. So, you know, they come to meditate or, you know, for higher spiritual practices.
And yogis are fighting?
Yeah, they're fighting. There are locks on the caves. And there is actually one yogi was murdered by another because he could not tolerate the fame he received. And, you know, in contrast to that, we sent one Prabhupada's book into nowhere in a war zone or anything, and people start chanting, reading the book.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to say Prabhupada's books are real tirtha, and you also touched on that point.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. That's my comment.
Thank you for the very nice class, Tamara Prabhu. Initially you mentioned about the dham, and the importance of the dham is hearing. That's what's meaningful. I also wanted to hear, as far as the dham, just going to the dham and being in the dham, and let's say just thinking about, okay, I'll go to the dham and get absorbed in Srila Prabhupada's books or like that. Being in the dham and doing that, and does it have extra potency? As I mean, even, you know, Prabhupada talks about these are Vaikunthas, our temples, or if we have worshipping deities at our house, then that's like a temple. But I guess I wanted to hear more. About being in the
dham. I don't think this is meant in any way to diminish the effect of the tirthas or the dham. Certainly there's great potency there. I mean, Prabhupada just mentioned that the best thing is to go to the dham, if you can hear from, you know, great personalities while you're there. But especially the Goswamis write a lot about the incredible value. I mean, within the Nectar Instruction, how does Rupa Goswami end it? He said, you know, who would not go to Radha Kund and live there? Well, a lot of us wouldn't. But, you know, in other words, and Raghunatha Das Goswami in Manashikshi talks a lot about the potency of the dham and being there because it's non-different than Krishna. So certainly there's great benefit, great power in the holy dhams because of their sameness with Krishna and his potency.
Yeah, no, I didn't feel like you were in any way minimizing. I guess I wanted to hear more about, especially because that I'm going to the holy dham.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted to hear more about the dham itself, the potency, or if you had some more, I guess, realizations or information on.
Yeah, well, probably not so much realization, but I mean, it's certainly something that devotees experience, I think, and many devotees, you know, we go to the dhams, we feel rejuvenated, we feel, you know, great spiritual benefit, and sometimes even wonderful, miraculous things happen with devotees in the dham. So it's certainly there. And of course, every dham's a little bit different, too, and they have different effects. You know, like I noticed in Mayapur, like it seems really effortless to chant, you know, and everything. It just seems like the process is that you're just getting this great mercy. At least that's my experience. And my experience in Vrindavan is that Vrindavan can be very, very wonderful, and also can be tough. That Krishna can give you challenges, and I mean, some devotees experience that too. You know that it's really different. The different qualities of the dhams, but yes, they're there for our benefit, and they're of course, when Krishna's there, the dhams are called the prakriti, you know, manifestation. And now, of course, you can experience, but Krishna stays in the dham. Like specifically, he mentions how he stays in Vrindavan in his aprakriti, which is the prakriti, you know, I hate to say the unmanifest manifestation. You know, I mean, grammatically it doesn't make sense, but I don't know how else to say it. Because aprakriti means unmanifest, but yet he is there in that form, in his unmanifest form. And so Krishna's always there. And they say that, you know, that Krishna never leaves Vrindavan. Well, that was not just when he went away and went to Dwarka, but even still today, he's there. And I guess if you have that vision and you're able to sort of penetrate the material covering somewhat. And of course, that's another thing. You notice that, you know, Krishna also creates the coverings, right? You know, it's dirty, it's, you know, miserable weather, all of that, you know. material aspects aren't really that. I mean, when you read Krishna book, you read the 10th canto, Vrindavan is absolutely incredible, the most beautiful place in the entire spiritual material universe, right? And you look at it now, it's a little harder to see. But you get, again, the divine eyes behind that. You know, then it's like, it's all there. It's all made of Chintamani. It's all wonderful. So anyway, Winnie, you're going where?
Vrindavan.
Yeah. Well, very nice. I hope you have a very incredible experience there and enlightened. Okay. Gotta go.
Could you explain a little bit, because Krishna manifested the universal form to Arjuna.
Yeah.
But then you said, or the prophet said, it was imaginary, mm-hmm. right?
More or less, yeah.
So, could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, were you here when I read the purport where Prabhupada talked about how his imagination, Rupa, in the beginning? I don't know, but I mean, I think Prabhupada said it about as well as anyone. That the universal form or Virata Rupa. Chris, universal form is a little different than the Virata Rupa. It's not exactly the same. You know, because he saw everything, you know, wonderful and horrific and all sorts of things there. And I guess it's real in the sense that it's Krishna's energy and Krishna's manifesting it. So there's a certain reality, but it's not a permanent form. It's not a real form that's there. It's more a way of, and in fact the devotees aren't really how did Arjuna react to it? He said, please take this away, right? I want to see your form as my friend Krishna, the chariot driver, you know, like that. So it's like a temporary manifestation or a way that Krishna, you know, manifests so that people can understand him in some way.
And sorry to change the subject from Vrindavan, because but I noticed in, like you were saying in Vrindavan, sometimes you can't see how it describes in Krishna book.
Yeah.
But actually I noticed that, like anywhere you go, like say Roshana, but you can feel it.
A little bit, it's hard.
You can feel it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah.
You can still feel it.
I think so. I think devotees can experience the spirituality, you know, the spiritual essence that's there, even if we don't see it with our material eyes. Yeah.
Hare Krishna.
No,
I wanted to appreciate the morning program, first of all, because you were talking about how we need the association of devotees to understand the scriptures, and so right away my mind started thinking, okay, I got to make plans, I got to figure out in my schedule how I can go associate with devotees in the community, and then I realized I'm doing it right now. Tamahara is that beautiful association. He's helping me understand, and we have this every day, and it's so accessible, so appreciate that. When you were talking about seeing Krishna through the Virat Rupa, and you know, these are ways to connect with him in the daily life, everything that we see. Are there ways that you could suggest to connect with Krishna through one's occupation? Because a lot of us spend at least 50% of our lives at work. And the Bhagavad Gita is all about telling Arjuna not to give up his prescribed duty and, you know, don't go to the forest, don't become a yogi, do your job, do it well, do it as an offering to me. So what are some ways that we can connect to that part of the Virat Rupa, our occupation?
Well, in today's verse, we're hearing about how Krishna manifests as the sky. You get to see a lot of sky. I think the answer, first of all, is try to see that everything you're doing is doing it for Krishna. Now, sometimes it seems a little remote. I mean, honestly, I feel that way, you know, household life too, because sometimes you kind of wonder, you know, am I really, is this really for Krishna? It just seems like, but no, it is, there is dharma. I mean, that's a fact of life. There's dharma we have to do, and Krishna says, do your prescribed duties. He never says, don't do your prescribed duties. You know, and things come at a certain time and season, you know, in life. And as you get older and those household duties are a little bit less and the children are grown and things like that, you know, then you want to put more time into just more spiritual activities or whatever. But also, it's like when you think about it, you have to sort of think about it in the totality. What are we doing? Well, in family life, what's the goal? That the family is Krishna conscious, right? That we try to make our children devotees as much as possible, give people devotional service. Husband and wife should support each other in Krishna consciousness, encourage one another, and try to actually help and increase that. It shouldn't be a detriment, actually. And Prabhupada said that. I mean, if the husband and wife are both Krishna conscious devotees and they're, you know, wanting to make progress, you know, then it's actually it can become beneficial, not detrimental. And in so many ways we can just, I think a lot of it is just trying to keep that, just as you're doing, asking that question, thinking about it, making it part of your life, you know. And obviously there's the obvious things, trying to hear, chant, read, things like that, however you can. And of course, there's always the idea of giving the fruits of one's work to Krishna. So if there's any extra money, a lot of times there isn't much in today's world and household life, but if there is, you know, I always try to donate to the temple. I don't have much money, but to try to donate something, you know, those kind of things. We just try to, and obviously, seeing Krishna, I mean, there's just so many ways that we can engage in devotional service, hearing, remembering, archanam, bandhanam, prayer. You know, the nine processes are actually pretty available to most people when you think about it. You know, you don't have to necessarily do something spectacular. You know, it's really the mood of devotion. You know, not like, you know, because, anyway. Where have we got Rabbanika?
And of course, there's always opportunities, if we're looking for them, to distribute prasadam in some form or another. I think you do that already. So it's something that most everyone can find a way at their workplace or something. You know, Halloween is coming. They have containers of, you know, candy and stuff or whatever. Yeah.
Thank you for adding. I think it's really important. And I know I was trying to do that when I was working in jobs and stuff, is trying to distribute prasadam a little bit if you can, yeah. Hmm.
I do have a question. Earlier you cited that verse in the Bhagavatam, by rendering service to the pure devotee, a great standard of service is done, and by such service one develops an affinity for hearing the message of Vasudev.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. Like, but then again, Prabhupada would say, if someone was leaving the class or going out before the class, he says, well, what can they accomplish then? If they are not hearing, they will not stay. So there's one, the verse that you cited supports, do service, 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 and in time you'll develop an affinity for attending the Bhagavatam class or hearing regularly. Mm-hmm. You get it, what I'm asking?
Well, both have to be there, I think. In other words, you're saying, well, is this just saying that if you just do enough service, then you're going to develop, you know, a taste for, an affinity for the Bhagavatam? Well, you also have to hear the Bhagavatam to gain a taste for the... I mean, I think the point here is that serving devotees, pure devotees, obviously is going to assist our devotional service, is going to bring us closer and give us more understanding, realization, and taste for hearing. But you also have to hear. I mean, you're not going to develop a taste all of a sudden, you know, like I've never read any of the Prabhupada's books, and all of a sudden, because I've just been working real hard, and all of a sudden I'm just going to, I suppose it's possible, but it's not generally the recommended process. The thing about any particular verse or any particular thing we read is, you know, it gives you one slice. Or, you know what I mean? And Krishna consciousness is very multifaceted. There's so many aspects of it. Like sometimes I think I've given a real complete class and someone will say, well, what about this and something I completely missed? Yeah, okay, I missed that point. Yeah, you know, there's so many. So, yeah.
I had a few questions, but I'll just ask one. I was just thinking,
it's just 9 o'clock.
Because I appreciate your presentation, it was very nice. I was thinking, like, what makes Holy Land or Dham as Dham? Why that particular place is called Holy Dham? Mm-hmm. Or what makes Holy Man holy? So you gave a very nice, I would say, some nice key points that when their heart is saturated with the, I'm paraphrasing you what I understood, heart is saturated with the Krishna divine qualities, Krishna's reciprocation, and they're always chanting or trying to distribute. That's what makes the person holy, man. Not just dress or living in a some name of a holy place doesn't make a holy man holy. So similarly, I remember Bhaktivinoda Thakur's explanation on Chaitanya Charitamrita. He said, Dhamer upori jaro mayapati jal achchadiya rakhe dham ei chirakal Sri Krishna Chaitanya jar nahiko sambandho dhamer upori bas kare sei andham. This is just for the reference, those who are listening online. That holy dham is not a holy dham to all, only those saintly, vibrant devotee who has a connection through Chaitanya Mahaprabhu actually have access to the holy dham and they live in that holy dham. Otherwise, the rest of the place is covered by maya with a covering. And people who doesn't have a relationship to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu or this disciplic succession, they may live in that land, but actually they are living on the top of the covering of maya.
Yeah.
That's a very scary, I mean...
I've heard that something like that before. I don't know if you can explain that a little bit, because it's like, apparently it's possible to actually be living in the Dham, but you're not really in the Dham. Like,
Correct.
Sometimes you see in the Dham, people seem very materialistic, right?
Yeah.
You know, they're breaking their good principles and everything else, yeah. So... are they actually in the Dham? You know?
Well, Balladev Vidyavasan Thakur says, you can live in Mayapur, and the Ganges water will purify, because it flows through there. But if you eat the fish from the Ganges, you'll go to hell. So, are you in Holy Dham, or...
Yeah.
I mean, you can put so many logic. It's Ganges water, fish is from Ganges water. I can put logic, but it doesn't work.
No.
They'll go to hell. Could be in Holy Dham, sitting and eating fish. Because I saw in childhood, early life in Mayapur, the people eat fish sometimes, the local,
yeah.
Non-devotees I mean.
Yeah.
But they are not living in a Holy Dham,
right. Exactly.
In that sense. So it makes sense.
Yeah.
That those who have a connection with the disciplic succession and glorifying Krishna,
yeah.
They are living in Holy Dham.
I can't remember this exactly, the reference, but didn't Prabhupada say, at least at one point, that because so many people come to like wash away their sins and everything else,
yes.
And the rivers and that, in a sense, it's like, then you need the holy people to come and refresh them, or I'm not exactly...
Pure devotee.
Purify them again, right?
Yeah, pure devotee.
Yeah, pure devotee then makes it pure again.
Yeah, Tirtha Kurbanti, that's why that verse is there.
Yeah.
That pure devotee takes that impurity and makes the holy dham as a holy dham again.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Okay, we should end there. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
That was very nice.